From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in the last week of September at a suburban high school south of Houston, Texas. A 15-year-old freshman named Kobe Burin was reading a textbook in his geography class. As the New York Times tells the story, Kobe was checking out a map of the United States and noticed something strange. There was a section about immigration that referred to Africans brought to American plantations during the 16th, 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries. We're talking about slaves, of course, but for some reason, the textbook in this section referred to these men and women not as slaves, but as workers. Kobe was perturbed, as you might imagine a young African-American boy would be. He used his cell phone to take a picture of that textbook page and then sent it to his mother, Ronnie Dean Byrne. He added a short message for effect. We was real hard workers, wasn't we? Kobe's mother took to social media to denounce the caption. She said, quote, "This is what erasure looks like." Her messages gathered steam online, and eventually, McGraw-Hill Education, which published the book, apologized. The company vowed to change the wording in future books and its process. Here at Connections, we were curious. How does a mistake like this make it through editing? How does it get published at all? McGraw-Hill is a big name in the textbook industry. Their books in Texas and California can become models used by districts in other parts of the country, and so we wondered if any of that particular book had made it to the Rochester area. In a moment, we'll share what local school districts shared with us, and we're going to take a look at the process for how books are essentially vetted in the first place. But first, let me introduce my guest, and someone very closely involved in the vetting process is Audra Schmidt, who's the Executive Director for Social Studies in the Rochester City School District. Audra, nice to have you here. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
We have a couple of students here, University of Rochester freshmen and IB program graduates. Peck Chun is here. Peck, nice to have you.
Thank you.
And also here is Sheila Kiryu, again, a U of R freshman. Sheila, nice to have you as
Thank
well.
Thank you.
And I'm going to remind all of our guests, it's a packed studio. So when you're talking, right on top of those microphones. Also with us in studio is Virtus Robinson, a professor of history and African-American studies at Monroe Community College, and someone no stranger to taking a look at the language used to teach in high schools and higher levels about African-American history. Virtus, nice to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
And here as well is Jim Caswell. He's a middle years program coordinator and social studies chair at Joseph Wilson Magnin High School. Jim, nice to have you here.
Thank you.
And Teresa Sarkis-Cruz is here, diploma program coordinator at Wilson Magnin. Teresa, nice to have you as well.
Thank you.
All right, so we're a packed studio. And before we even go around to our guests, what I want to do is hear the words of this 15-year-old student who caught this issue and his mother. So first, this is what Kobe, the 15-year-old, told CNN about just simply what he noticed in his textbook in class.
It had Africans and African Americans as the Atlantic slave trade as workers, implying pay as if we had come here willingly and were paid to do our jobs.
And this is now Kobe's mother, Ronnie Dean Byrne, whose post on Facebook and Twitter helped spark this story, this national reaction to this. So here's Ronnie Dean Byrne describing what she saw and some of the concerns with it.
You see, it says one of the defining attributes of the United States is that it is largely a country of immigrants and their descendants. About 13% of the people in the United States are foreign-born, while Native Americans, Alaska Natives, and Native Hawaiians make up 2% of the population. The remaining population is descended from immigrants. Immigrants, yeah. That word matters, immigrants. The Atlantic slave trade between the 1500s and the 1800s brought millions of workers from Africa to the southern United States to work on agricultural plantations. So it is now considered immigration. And these are some other sections that sort of talk about the pattern of immigration. This section here in particular talks about English and European peoples, many of whom came as indentured servants to work for little or no pay. So they say that about English and European people, but there is no mention of Africans working as slaves or being slaves. It just says we were workers.
All right, that's Ronnie Dean Byrne. I want to read some of what we heard from McGraw-Hill. And McGraw-Hill was kind enough to email us a lengthy statement. They've already apologized for this, and I know I've been taking time to try to communicate with this family, with the district. But here's some of what they sent to Connections this morning. McGraw-Hill writes that slavery was a horrible part of American history. This is their quote from their statement. Slavery was a horrible part of American history. The book and program from which it is drawn, do describe in 15 places other than the caption the origins of the Atlantic slave trade, the forcible capture and enslavement of Africans, and the millions of lives lost. We did not change the history to make slavery or the slave trade less significant to readers in Texas. We are deeply sorry that the caption was written the way it was. While the book was reviewed by many people inside and outside the company and was made available for public review for more than 6 months, no one raised concerns about the caption. Yet clearly something went wrong, and we must and will do better. To learn from this and to prevent this from happening again, we are reviewing our internal processes to understand how it occurred. We are committed to increasing our list of reviewers to reflect greater diversity. We are reviewing the way we work to find ways to incorporate more, quote, cold reads, which are done by people who have not previously read the work to ensure a fresh perspective on materials in near final format. We are reaching out to experts with knowledge and expertise in different cultures to evaluate the next right steps. We changed the digital version of the caption, and that's from McGraw-Hill. They go on to say that they are helping teachers who want to explore better ways to teach, you know, the opportunity to do that, better lesson plans, et cetera. So, Virtus Robinson, I want to start with you, a professor of history and African-American studies at MCC. Is McGraw-Hill's statement good enough for you?
No. The reason why it's not good enough, I mean, it sounds all right, but this has been going on for a while. I mean, about 5 years ago, I was asked to review a textbook, and that textbook was okay. I mean, they had their paragraphs. I mean, it was a history, United States history book, that would be in high schools or, you know, first year college, and it was okay. It would have their paragraph or two highlighting African Americans in within that chapter. So I was like, okay, at least they gave some credit to African Americans within that chapter. But they when I was reviewing, I noticed that in the chapter about Reconstruction, that they had completely left out the first black congressman. And so, of course, my review was that in my classes, even American history classes, I would not utilize that textbook because of that fact. Even though everything else was okay, they had omitted that, and this was the sixth edition. So it is an ongoing problem, and I was not the only reviewer, but I would imagine that I was the only reviewer to catch that omission.
And real briefly, Virtus, the mom who was understandably upset about this, her son having found it in Texas, this obvious mistake, she used the word erasure. Is that the right word?
I would say erasure is okay, but I would say revisionist history is what I would really call it. And the reason why I would call it revisionist history is because even in the textbook, they do say that African Americans were forced and everything, but these little, even though it was a little caption, it spoke 1,000 words right there by calling them workers. And it really sugarcoats slavery. And even that's not even the correct scholarly word for people who were enslaved. They were enslaved people. That was their status. That was not their identity. They were people. They were people of African descent, and they were enslaved. That is the current scholarly designation for people of color who were enslaved.
All right. So the caption we're talking about, revisionist history, leaving the first black congressman out, that's erasure. Okay. So that those are some of the complaints that we're going to be working through, how these things come together. Teresa Sarkis-Cruz wanted to jump in here again. She's the Diploma Program Coordinator at Wilson Magnet. Go ahead.
Well, I think the statement that McGraw-Hill made really doesn't go far enough. You know, if a product is on the marketplace and it's bad, often we issue a product recall. These books persist in the schools for sometimes 10, 15 years. I would suggest to McGraw-Hill that they actually pull the books and replace them with books that have been corrected, because although the digital version has been corrected, you know, very few people will have access to those corrections.
Let me read the full text then toward the end there where they talk about this. They said that we changed the digital version of the caption. We've offered our customers a choice of either a new corrected copy of the book or a corrected caption to place over the incorrect one. The return books with the incorrect copy will be recycled. In addition, we met with the mother who brought this to our attention and apologized to her. So what they're saying is we can send you something to kind of paste over it. So first step? Right. What do you think?
Yeah, it's a beginning, but also are they moving to include a more diverse board in their vetting process? Because I think that's also another step that needs to be made.
Okay, Jim Caswell, what are your thoughts on just in general the way this kind of mistake will enter a textbook? Does this concern you enough to think, boy, what else is out there? Or are you thinking, I'm hoping this is a one-off, et cetera?
It's definitely concerning, but you know, as a social studies teacher, this is a great learning opportunity because one of the jobs that we have as an instructor is to teach our students to investigate every resource that they're utilizing and consider the source and the perspective of that person. So within the classroom, this is a great learning opportunity that I think is highly engaging for students. Right. It leads to a great classroom discussion. Mm-hmm.
Listeners, if you're just joining us, we're talking about the story that was in the New York Times about a month ago out of a suburban district just south of Houston, Texas, where a 15-year-old student found a caption in his geography textbook, a McGraw-Hill textbook, that referred to enslaved Africans as workers, essentially immigrant workers, and not enslaved people. And so we're working through how that could happen. The company has apologized, but that has sparked questions around the country on what else is out there. In a moment, we're going to kind of work through what we found locally, but let me also ask the rest of our panelists, Audra Schmitz here, who's the executive director for social studies with the Rochester City School District. When it comes to the process in the city schools, Audra, you know, the question on when books come in, how they come in, what is that process like?
It's quite an elaborate process, and it takes a large number of people who are collaboratively working together to really, really investigate the best resource to use. Because of the cost of these textbooks and the awareness that we have about the impact of this resource, they're very careful. And so this is a whole process that's very consistent across Monroe County. This would not just be a Rochester City School District process. Textbook approval processes are always vetted through the Board of Education. And the process starts when there's a need, a new course, perhaps a new set of standards like we've just seen within social studies. New York has just released the K-12 social studies framework, and that's really cueing us with what are the appropriate resources to use. And quite frankly, the textbooks are, they're behind in that process to support. Textbooks are not curriculum. They are a resource. And so that process starts when there's a need. And what we do is a committee is formed. And as a social studies director, I would be an important part of that process from start to finish. And the committee would be comprised of really important stakeholders in the district, the grade level teachers, and not just any grade level teacher, but the people who have the most important depth of content and experience. The other layers, the people who are very, very knowledgeable about English language learners, special education, bilingual. These are all the stakeholders, including, most importantly, families and parents, the community members. And so this committee is formed. They reach out to vendors. We bring in some desk copies, supplemental materials, online sources, and the process begins. Most of the time, in all cases that I'm familiar with, there's a piloting process, not just in one classroom, but in multiple classrooms, and that feedback process is absolutely critical. At that point, the feedback is back, and there's been a criteria set by this committee, rubrics set, then a recommendation is made to a subcommittee of the school board, and the subcommittee would then hear the presentations, feedback process, and remember, it's all open to the public, so it's a very elaborate process.
And how often are we flagging things that stand out as maybe inappropriate?
Through that process, absolutely. You're looking at, is it serving the needs of our learners? Does it have the content balance? For example, the city school district is working very closely with the Rochester Teacher Center moving forward to be very trained in culturally responsive pedagogy. With that background, with that training, and with that awareness, the filters are stronger. And the family that caught that, mm-hmm. would have been able to do that because of that background and that knowledge base of the family.
All right, so two follow-up points then. It sounds like if Rochester is an indication of what is common around the country, there are a lot of layers that should prevent something as egregious mm-hmm. as not referring to as enslaved people, as enslaved. That should never happen. Even one time in one caption, there are that many layers. And so, first of all, do you find yourself wondering, Audra, how that even got through on McGraw-Hill's side to be published to begin with? Does that surprise you?
It's surprising on many levels, but really the strength of the committee and the strength of the process is what would catch something like this.
Rochester?
In Rochester, absolutely. Most importantly, we're a big market. Rochester City Schools is a huge market. And, you know, and as the framework from the state has come out for social studies, and the publishers are all over this, they know that, you know, when we purchase a lot. And it's very lucrative for the publishers. When you have the right people in place, you're not so quick to just run and purchase a new textbook, because that, in this day and age, 10 years ago, maybe this is going to be your critical source. In 2015, it is not. We have a menu of resources that we can use, and the textbook is not as critical as it used to be in the past. In addition, we're more knowledgeable, and we know what to look for with that committee that's been put together with the depth of knowledge and the understanding of culturally responsive pedagogy.
Okay, so before I turn to our students, our recent graduates here, let me just kind of circle back then. And Teresa, then it sounds to me like what McGraw-Hill is saying is, we made a mistake, we're giving them an option, either send us the book back or we can send you a correction. Would you have liked them to come out and say, that book is dead, send it back, we're considering it obsolete?
I would like that, because I think that that's going to send a message.
Step, yeah.
Right. It's going to send a message to the population in general. It is egregious, and it's going to hurt us financially, and we know that, and we're going to make amends.
Okay. So they could have done that. That wasn't the step they took, but they are trying to offer what they call a fix. And Virtus Robinson, just real briefly, one of the steps they say they're now taking is, as intricate as the process may be in vetting, they're admitting we need more diversity in the vetting process. At least, is that a constructive step?
That is a constructive step, but it's going to be a problem.
Why do you say that?
Well, because they look to towards professors on the higher ed level, and, you know, quite frankly, there are not that many of us who are into African-American studies and history of that. I'm not just saying black professors, but there are not that many black professors either. So where they're going to find the diversity even in higher ed, it's a problem.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let me ask our students who are in the room. And again, we've got Peck Chun and Sheila Kiryu, who are both University of Rochester freshmen and IB program graduates. Let me start with Sheila. When you saw this story to begin with, when you saw that level of text, that referring to 15th, 16th, 17th, and 18th century enslaved Africans as workers, essentially immigrant workers, instead of enslaved people. As a student, I imagine you can't recall encountering anything like that in your own studies here. What would you have thought? Can you imagine what you would have thought as a student had you seen that?
Yeah, as everyone has said, I agree that this is definitely not acceptable. And just as my former teacher, Mr. Sarkis, said, I think it would definitely help to, like they said, they mentioned something about, you know, diversity, like to have diversity in the reviewing board. That's definitely important, because we're talking about a very touchy topic to, like, we all know about the American history. And I think one of my former teachers, she mentioned something about using peer-reviewed journal articles, which is what my high school, Joseph C. Wilson Magnet, emphasizes on that, because it's usually the peer-reviewed article are usually, like, reviewed by, like, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
They're usually reviewed by a board that consists of diverse people from diverse backgrounds. So I think that if we had, like, someone representing the black black perspective, then this definitely wouldn't have gone through this book definitely wouldn't have been published, because it's not okay, because this is a very touchy topic, for the black students, and again, like, regarding the American history. So I definitely think that something needs to be done about this. So just changing it, it's not going to really, change like the emotions that have caused like everyone is like, you know, it's not acceptable.
Sure. And I think what we're looking at is one particular caption, but then the broader subject that Virtus Robinson was talking about, which is you can look at one caption in one book that's an obvious egregious error. But then the broader question is, are we teaching effectively to begin with? The African-American experience, are we teaching it honestly? Sheila, in your studies, did you feel like it was addressed as comprehensively as you understand it now? You know, do you have any thoughts about the way education could change in that way?
Yeah, just like I said, in my high school, I had my school emphasized on using peer-reviewed articles. So, like, most of the time we would use the resources to, like, find all this information from, like, you know, really, like, high-level intellectual, like, information from like people from different people who presented like different backgrounds. Like when I started in school, like freshman year, you would basically accept everything as knowledge. But then we went to high school and we were involved in the IB program, and we would take classes like theory of knowledge. And so from there, you would just pretty much start questioning everything, and then you use all these resources that was available to us. And from using that, it's like you would just start questioning everything. You wouldn't just accept anything. Like if I was a student and I had read this, I would. You know, like, at freshman year, I would probably just be like, you know, it's, maybe it was just a mistake, but, like, going through the IB program and using all these peer-reviewed articles, it just made me question everything, and I don't really accept anything as just knowledge anymore.
Your former teacher across the table is smiling. Yeah. Not That's what they're taught to do. And Peck, let me ask you the same kind of question. You know, for you, what do you look back at your own educational experience in light of this conversation, in light of the way these textbooks come together, do you feel like, hey, we had it pretty good where you went to school, or does that make you question the process more?
Oh yeah, for sure. So we went through the IB program, and one of the emphasis that the IB program gives is that we have to question our source of knowledge, and that is done through multiple classes such as TOK, where how do we know what we know, and in history class where we evaluate the sources through OPVL. And something like this is definitely a limitation on the source. And these kind of critical thinkings is really important. And one of the things that I'm really grateful for is that IB has really emphasized that. And through that, something like this in reflection, it's a, like Mr. Caswell said, it's a great learning opportunity because here's the firsthand context, like firsthand experience of, you know, the limitation of a textbook.
Well, we've got representatives from the University of Rochester, yeah, two students now, but also the Rochester City School District responded very quickly and forcefully on this story, helping us see what their process is like. We've been learning that from Audra Schmidt, who's the executive director for social studies at the City School District. Jim Caswell is the middle years program coordinator and social studies chair for Wilson Magnet. Teresa Sarkis Cruz is the diploma program coordinator at Wilson Magnet. We also have Virtus Robinson, who's here, a professor of history and African American studies at MCC. You're waiting on the phone, so let's do this. Let's take a short break. When we come back, we're going to get to your phone calls. And our producer, Megan Mack, had reached out to every district in Monroe County as a kind of representative sample. What's out there when it comes to textbooks? Because it's not exactly like when you and I went to school. There are online sources. Not everybody's using textbooks in the same way. And we're going to find out what Connections was able to find out in reaching out to various districts to find out, just to make sure, was this particular book that was used in Texas, was that caption, did that find a way into any of the books around here? We're going to tell you what we found next. Coming up in our second hour, we talk to Jeff Smith, a former state senator who went to prison for a year and wrote a book from the inside. He wants to expose just exactly why our prison system seems to conspire against the prisoners, hurting their chances of getting out and becoming successful, landing jobs, and not going back. Jeff Smith, about life in prison, next.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from the Rochester Philharmonic Orchestra, presenting NPR's From the Top with Christopher O'Reilly and RPO Music Director Ward Stair, Sunday, January 17th. Tickets available at rpo.org.
Welcome back to Connections. We were just remarking about how quickly the hour is going, and I want to bring in Megan Mack, who's the producer of the program. Megan has been reaching out to all 21, essentially 21 districts in this county, right, Meg?
21 districts. That includes Monroe and Orleans-Boces.
Okay, 21 districts. How many districts responded to your request?
We heard back from 16. Okay. So we heard back from the majority, which is good. And I asked them four questions in the message that we sent. I asked, do your schools use textbooks or online sources or both in the classrooms? Do your schools use McGraw-Hill textbooks? Do your schools use McGraw-Hill World Geography textbooks? And what is the primary publisher for the school's textbooks?
Okay, and so you've got this handy chart that I'm holding right now, and I wonder if maybe when we podcast this program, we can stick it online with the podcast, because that will help our listeners work through what Megan was able to find. What we essentially found, as best I can tell, is that there is no local district using a McGraw-Hill book that would have this caption. Is that right, Megan?
Correct. That is correct.
Okay, so the caption in question, and again, if you're just joining us, came from a school district in Texas, south of Houston, in which one of the geography books referred to, in one caption of a map, it referred to enslaved Africans as workers, essentially immigrant workers and not enslaved people. And that kind of sparked an outrage. McGraw-Hill has apologized. And it doesn't look like that caption is here. But there's a number of districts that use McGraw-Hill. That's pretty common, right, Megan?
Yes. Yep. Okay, it's one of the primary publishers in many of the districts. And there is one district that does use a McGraw-Hill World Geography book. That's Honeyoy Falls, Lima. And I spoke with Dr. Renee Williams this morning. She's the assistant superintendent for curriculum and instruction at Honeyoy Falls, Lima. And she read me the section of that book, Patterns of Immigration. That's the section that correlates with the Texas book. And in that section, it refers to slaves as enslaved workers, and it uses a variety of maps to show where enslaved people came from. So it was very fair and accurate.
Okay, so HFL, and I think we're going to talk to someone from HFL in just a few minutes here, because when you followed up, Megan, what was interesting was HFL didn't just say, we have the book of that title from McGraw-Hill, but that caption does not exist. The egregious, the incorrect caption is not in our book. They didn't just say that and sort of wash their hands and move on. They told you that they view this as an important dialogue moment in a district, in their own words, that is not basically diverse at all, right?
Yes, they said there's not a lot of racial diversity in their district, and there's one social studies teacher, Mike Merrill, who we'll be speaking to in about 6 or 7 minutes, who's using this as a conversation in his classroom. He said it's important to have these types of conversations about history and about racial issues in current times, so his students know that they need to be open-minded.
Okay, and Megan, when it comes to textbooks or online sources, Was it different from district to district? Were most using online sources? What did you find?
The most use a mixture of both online sources and textbooks. And there were a few that mentioned additional materials like library materials and documentaries. So it really spanned the gamut. But most use both textbooks and online sources.
Okay. And so if you're wondering who didn't respond, I'm just going down the list here. 21 districts we reached out to, 16 responded with information. Churchville, Chilai, no response. East Rochester, no response. Greece and Hilton, no response. And there was one more that did not respond?
Yes, that was.
We're going down our long
going
list.
Going through. West Ronicoit Central School District. Okay. They responded that they were working on it, but we haven't heard back yet.
Okay. Yeah,
those were a few of those.
Yeah, that's not to indict anybody, just trying to provide as much information as we can. Thank you, Megan. Very helpful.
Thank you.
And so that's Megan Mack, producer, who's been working on this story for us. So that caption, you're not going to find it in local textbooks as best that we can find. But before I go to the phones, Audrey Schmidt was telling us about another part of the process that is available to districts but might not really be as available as we'd like it to be, which means if you want to customize a book, take most of a book that you get from McGraw-Hill but then sort of customize it, I guess you can, but it's cost prohibitive, Audrey?
Yeah, it is. The school district, Rochester City Schools, did pursue this with our kindergarten through second grade social studies textbooks. It was an enormous project. It was an expensive project, but the outcome was so powerful because the publisher, and it wasn't through McGraw, it was through Pearson. They came to the Rochester area. The photographs that they took were of our community. Our students were in this textbook, and so the face of our children was in this resource. It's an exciting prospect, but the cost associated with this does make many districts shy away from doing this from a K-12 perspective.
You'd like to do more of it?
I think it's an opportunity. But that said, this now puts a very important burden on the local committee putting this textbook together. So you want to make sure that your vetting process is even stronger, because you need people with the content background, the depth of knowledge, the pedagogical background. Your team to put this together is going to be really a critical.
All right, let me get to the phones. And Dwayne in Rochester has been waiting to join the conversation. Go ahead, Dwayne.
Hi, thank you. I'm a late tuning in on the program, but my understanding is that the conversation is about one caption in the book. I read the New York Times article some time ago, and one thing that stuck in my mind was that that wasn't the only thing the textbook writers did. They referred to the transport of slaves to America and other places as forced migration. And that really struck me. You know, that's like calling rape forced sex. There's no such thing as a kind of sex that is rape. Rape is rape. And similarly, chaining people to the bottoms of boats and taking them into slavery is no form of migration.
Well, Dwayne, thanks for the phone call. And I think that's some of what Virtus Robinson, a professor of history and African-American studies at MCC, has been saying, is that, you know, we should be concerned about the caption, which you found personally offensive, but we should also be questioning, you know, the larger vetting process and making sure that the textbooks are what we want to be teaching. What would you say to Dwayne?
Yeah, I would say that forced migration, we would definitely need a different term than forced migration. I agree that forced migration infers that they came over, but that something was wrong where they came from and they were forced to leave where they were and come over here instead of the process that we all know. But the one that concerns me is that I assume that we all know that how you know what slavery was like, that we all know. I mean, we cannot assume that everybody, every student knows about slavery and also knows how it really was. For one thing, we're now getting to the point where we're uncovering a lot that has been covered up as in regards to slavery and the period after slavery. I mean, I agree with him, and so we're working. The African-American studies scholars, we're working, and we're doing what we can. But there's not that many of us, and so I'm not saying we're fighting a losing battle, but what's going on nationally is very indicative of this kind of mindset and the revisionist history.
And what's very interesting is with the last few years, especially the last 5 to 8 years, there's been so much scholarly work done on this. The textbooks can't catch up.
Right.
It's not a nimble process, and that's why the textbook cannot be the curriculum, and it needs to be one resource in a menu of sources that are nimble, they're balanced, and they're very responsive.
All right, David writes to us on Twitter, "What makes you think this was a mistake that was missed rather than purposeful rewriting of history? I'm generally a pretty charitable guy when I think about mistakes people make, and I like to give the benefit of the doubt unless it's not sort of rewarded." Virtus Robinson, do you have any suspicion that would be intentional? I don't personally, but mm-hmm. I don't have a whole lot of research to back that up. What do you think?
I mean, it's the same reason why you won't see the word slave in the Constitution. I mean, it is really indicative of, I think it was unconscious that people just looked at it and glossed over it and didn't really look at it very closely. And it is not, and I don't think it was just, we didn't catch it. It was that as a society, and as you know, as we like to revise history a lot, that people just didn't look at it. People glossed over it, and that is a shame. And so, hopefully, you know, with this, and again, I love people who use this as a learning tool. Also, use it as example if you do see it. As a student, that the 15-year-old student did, question everything you read in these textbooks.
Or as our IB students.
Oh, absolutely.
Have been saying this.
Yeah. I mean, that's why I'm glad. I mean, I would love for MCC students, I mean, people who come to MCC to be able to do that. That is essential. Like, don't trust everything you read on the internet or on Facebook.
But
you know, question everything.
But in other words, Virtus, when David on Twitter is saying, "What makes you think this was an honest mistake and not purposeful?" What you're saying, it's actually kind of in the middle, in that
right.
You know, no one is we don't assume anyone's trying to fully erase the idea of slavery, but we're sort of embarrassed or shamed or pained about it, and maybe we use euphemism to make us feel better when that's a mistake.
Or making light of a situation that, you know, let's move on from this, you know. Almost like slavery wasn't so bad. There wasn't that many slaves. Only 25% of Southerners owned slaves. I mean, but they owned 4 million. And, I mean, and let me just tell you one quick thing that I was personally insulted by this was that, you know, the story of my great-great-grandmother who was whipped to death in front of her children. This was like in 1864, the year before she was supposed to be freed, and she was whipped in front of her children. And someone that was whipped to death is not a worker. They are enslaved and oppressed and abused.
Go ahead, Audrey.
What's really exciting is the State Ed Department has released this K-12 social studies framework, and what is so exciting about this for educators across the state is it's really pushing teachers to change and shift their instruction. It's pushing students to really think about their thinking. It's asking them to really dive into those college and career ready skills that, and I know, Jim, you've done a lot of kind of close read and work with this. The potential of what we can do to help support learning, the critical thinking skills, the historical habits of mind. No student will look at a resource again in the same way.
Yeah, a good social studies teacher will use a variety of resources. And there's kind of a struggle in a social studies class because there's so much content that you feel pressured. You know, in New York State, there's so much emphasis on the Regents exams, and our priority in some ways, some people would argue, is to get those students prepared for those exams. So you got to drive the content. But there's more of an emphasis over the last couple of years to focus more on the skills that the kids need, right? being critical thinkers, being able to analyze documents, look at the language, and really kind of understand and question what's being said. Evan, I just wanted to throw out one other thing, because I know that in 2010, the state of Texas redid their learning standards within their public education system, and that's a heavy conservative state. So I'm just wondering if this is maybe, you know, related to that you know, sort of the legislative body in passing new educational standards and the people that were chosen to vet this process. Because the New York Times article, I think, talked about how there was an emphasis to promote, you know, sort of Republican economic ideals. There was another effort to sort of limit the battle between church and state. So I wonder if we could research more and talk more about it, if we could see some sort of connection that this was part of an impact of those new standards that were created.
The best we can tell is from what we've been able to dig into, we don't know. That's possible. Certainly McGraw-Hill is saying that they try to be thorough. They try to vet that this was a mistake and a bad one, and that they're trying to make good on it. And that they're also saying that in that same book, there's 15 other references to enslaved people. So they're saying, I think some of what you're hearing Jim bring up, who is the middle years program coordinator at Wilson Magnet, is that in some more conservative parts of the country, there's this view that, well, let's not talk too negatively about American history, American past. And that may be in line with what Virtus Robinson has been saying, which is that certain things should make us uncomfortable, but we shouldn't use euphemism to make us feel better in 2015 or whenever a textbook's being created. But was that the root of this? I don't know. It's an interesting question. I want to bring in on the phone Mike Merrill, and we're going to get through as many of your phone calls as we can for the rest of the hour. Mike Merrill's on the line with us. He is the social studies chair at Honey I Falls Lima High School. And Mike, thanks for taking time out of your day. How are you?
No problem. I'm well. Thanks for having me. I've missed most of the conversation because I've been busy teaching, but I'm here to I guess, give some insight from HFL perspective.
Yeah, I know it's busy for everyone, so I'll only take a few minutes of your time. Mike, you were someone we wanted to talk to because when our connections team did this look at local districts, essentially polling local districts to find out, do you have McGraw-Hill books, do you have this particular book, HFL was the only district that we saw had this exact title, but you also don't have the caption that was the egregious one, referring to enslaved people just as workers. So that's not in your books. But what was interesting was, you know, Megan Mack, our producer, came back and said, well, they're not just walking away from it, though. They view this as a chance to talk about these kinds of issues. Tell me about that, Mike.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I think it was probably a few months over the summer, I read an article, I don't know if it was New York Times or US Today, and I caught the glimpse of this, and I go, wow, that's the book that we just ordered. And we have a pretty intensive process for ordering books at HFL. We had three different teachers, and it gets approved by the board. So I would hope that we would have found something like this had it come up. But at any rate, I just found it interesting. So I went and checked out our textbook when we arrived at school, and it wasn't in our textbook. But I thought this is kind of a neat opportunity because I think probably previously mentioned, you know, in today's world of online resources, social media, you know, the power of language is pretty influential. And, you know, the opportunity to show this to students at our school and kind of have them identify what they see as the issue with this would be kind of an interesting learning experience. It's an opportunity for them to do some close reading, be analytical, and apply their critical thinking skills.
And Mike, before I let you go, I just wanted to ask you to comment on the subject that Jim Caswell was raising and others have raised, which is, can we talk about and can we teach about the uncomfortable parts of our history? And shouldn't we and mustn't we, even when it's difficult to look back, you know, so whatever was the genesis of this mistake with the McGraw-Hill textbook that referred to people who were enslaved as workers, whatever was the genesis of that, you know, how do we make sure we avoid that? And should we not be willing to accept euphemism? How do you feel about that, Mike?
Yeah, I think it's crucial that we take a look at our country's history in an unbiased way, that with the positive and the negative, that we can be critical of and look at both of them. And in this case, I don't think we can shy away from the issue at hand, which is, you know, the language over workers and enslavement, and that's a discussion that needs to be had. And if part of our nation's legacy is obviously mired by this terrible, history of slavery and other experiences, then we need to be open and analytical about that.
And Mike, are you concerned as a teacher at HFL, Honey I Falls Lima, you know, very little diversity in your district? There's not a whole lot of diversity in many suburban districts in our area. Are you concerned that students are kind of going through the educational process thinking, well, there's no such thing as racism anymore, structural or personal? I don't hear anyone use the N-word. I don't, you know, really experience structural racism. Are you concerned about that?
Yeah, sure. I, as a parent who has kids in the district and sends kids to suburban schools and have students, I'm definitely concerned. I mean, I think in comparison to maybe some other schools, we do lack diversity. But I think opportunities like this for them to be reflective on the world that we live in today and our past is an opportunity for them to be, have exposure to this. But I think that our kids living in a more global world actually do have more exposure than we think to diversity, because no longer are we really bound to our district's borders all the time. Because of social media and the internet, kids are interacting with other races, other ethnicities, and being exposed to that. And I think that education is the key to enhancing that. So,
Mike Merrill is the social studies chair at HFL, taking the time to call the program and share his district's thoughts, even though their textbook does not carry that the incorrect and problematic language. Mike, thanks for taking the time to call the program and kind of step up and talk about this, and I look forward to our next conversation.
No problem. Thanks a lot.
Let me get back to the phones because we've had a number of people waiting to weigh in, and Jim in Rochester is next. Go ahead, Jim.
Thank you. This is it's not a new phenomenon. It's we call it the sanitization of history. Let me give you a classical example. Robert E. Lee, Commanding General of the Confederate Army, was a graduate of the United States Military Academy. He went to West Point, took an oath and a pledge to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States. He made war on the Constitution of the United States. You have some of the greatest generals out of the United States in the history of the world, starting with Gulf War I, Swakoff, very successful general, never made war on the Constitution. Colin Powell, never made war. General Dwight Eisenhower became the President of the United States, graduate of West Point, never made war on the Constitution. Petraeus, successful, wrote the book on counterterrorism, how to fight a war, asymmetric warfare, never declared war on the Constitution. And you go to Virginia now, in Petersburg, there's a big military installation there. It's logistics, basically quartermaster. where they train the Army, Air Force, Navy, and Marine Corps on how to supply Army 10,000 miles or a military fighting force 10,000 miles on the other side of the world. It's called Fort Lee. There's a huge painting, portrait of the general in there. If you go in there, you think he was an ideal citizen of the country. That's why this is not a new phenomenon. I just had a friend of mine who gave 75 rare books to the African American Museum that's part of the Smithsonian. Some were published as far back as 1836, 1856, 1810. And you think this textbook in Texas was bad. That was mild stuff compared to what was published.
Jim, the next thing you're going to tell me is that people still fly the Confederate flag in this country. Come on.
Well, they do. They believe that. All you do is go south of go south and you'll see it. But I will say this. You had two school administrators there and one teacher that talked about Texas, and he believed that in 2010, the conservative state of Texas had a philosophy that they wanted their textbooks to be more positive oriented towards their ideology, philosophy, and I think he's right. And it was another school administrator there who said, and she was correct, we can't believe everything we read in the textbooks. We have to open up and use other resources. That's correct. And I'm going to close with this. There was a speaker of the House of Representatives, Newt Gingrich, of all people, a conservative. He authored a book with a PhD that did extensive research, a book called The Crater. It was about Petersburg, Virginia, because this, who controlled Petersburg was going to win the Civil War. And Ulysses Grant went down there and tore the place up. Okay. In fact, your PBS television just did a special on the Civil War. And that book that he wrote outlined the basic premise. It was the first African-American to receive a battlefield commission officer from West Point because of valor on the battlefield and that battle in the crater. And by the way, the guy who wrote the instrument of surrender that Robert E. Lee had to sign in Appomattox, Virginia, was a Native American. Parks was his name, Seneca Indian, grew up on the Tonawanda Reservation in Buffalo, New York. So there's a lot we can learn and do. But I would suggest to our students, I just left Washington this past weekend, and you're talking about a diverse town. That is diversity.
Well,
here, you know, we've sort of been isolated and insulated. But to go into a global economy and compete now, your entire thinking and philosophy is going to have to change.
Well, Jim, thank you for the phone call, and only because we're going to run out of time. I'll just say one of the most surprising moments on this program since I started hosting it was earlier this year. I had an author named Carlo DeVito on who wrote a book called Mrs. Lee's Rose Garden. It's about the founding of Arlington National Cemetery and the often untold story of Robert E. Lee and his wife and what happened at Arlington and the divisions he had between Lee and General Montgomery Meigs and the way Robert E. Lee's betrayal of this country's cause impacted his personal relationships and the way Arlington was founded. And we actually had a listener, and I think he might even call, I think Stephen in Brighton, a very nice guy, Southern gentleman who moved up here, said that we view Robert E. Lee as a chivalrous man, a man with great sort of moral standing. He was an interesting guy, I understand that up to a point, but then we have to look at it in the view of history. Vertus Robinson, Robert E. Lee betrayed the country and supported slavery, and that's should not be controversial anymore, right?
Well, the thing about it is just like, the thing about Robert E. Lee is like, actually, Abraham Lincoln wanted him. He was trying to recruit him.
Oh, of course.
But Robert E. Lee was just like, well, I'm a Virginian. Yeah. So if Virginia is seceding,
right.
I'm seceding
so
too.
He chose the state over the country.
Right.
He did, and he was recruited by both sides.
Right. I mean, the same problem that we're having with John C. Calhoun. Woodrow Wilson is up in the news right now, what's going on in Princeton. I'm interested to see what happens with all of this. Do we wipe everything clean, or do we take them as learning opportunities?
I couldn't agree more. And Jim, thank you for the phone call. What I want to do is just kind of get some final thoughts real briefly here. And Audra Schmidt, who's the Executive Director for Social Studies in the Rochester City School District, what do you want to leave our listeners with as we, not only as community members, but as parents, thinking about what our kids are learning and the materials they're learning from and how that happens? What do you want our listeners to know?
To serve our children, we need this collaborative effort to lift the level of instruction for our students, to see the complexities, to work with our colleagues at higher ed who do have the depth of knowledge, mm-hmm. who can help really work with our history teachers or social studies teachers to get that breadth, that depth, and really help us bring our children from our diverse community back into the classroom. And I don't believe a textbook is going to be able to do that. So I think we need to really move forward and work on this together and be able to serve our children better.
Okay.
Rochester deserves this.
And Teresa Sarkis-Cruz, some final thoughts, about 20 seconds?
Yeah, we have to teach the critical thinking skills. And at the center of the IB program is the learner. And if the learner can think critically and use the most timely resources, JSTOR, Gale Group databases, then they're going to understand the various perspectives and be better citizens.
Okay, Virtus Robinson.
Don't hide it. Come on out with it so we can fight it. That's all I have to say.
Okay. Jim Caswell, some final thoughts?
Textbook's just a resource. If your kid's coming home every day just reading out of the textbook, you need to start asking deeper questions like, what else are you doing? How are you utilizing? How is your teacher utilizing that classroom time? Because the textbook's just a resource.
I wish we had more time with our former students, Peck and Sheila, because they clearly were the kinds of students that their teachers, their social studies teachers, were applauding and are proud of them now as University of Rochester freshmen and IB program graduates who are sort of living that model that we saw from that 15-year-old in Texas who called out the district, who called out McGraw-Hill and said, this is not how we describe slavery and enslaved people. Thanks to our entire panel. Peck, Sheila, thanks for being here. Jim Caswell, Teresa Sarkis-Cruz, Audra Schmidt, and Virtus Robinson, great panel, and thank you for all of your expertise and thoughts on this. Wish we had a second hour. Huge amount of interest on this program. Short break, and we're talking about a story inside the American prison system next.